I love Proverbs 27:17. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Have you ever had a friend like that? Someone who always has your best interests in mind? Someone who helps you? Someone who really makes you better? Just makes you a better person, whether you're man or woman. Now, usually, we're used to hearing the other side of that, right? We're used to hearing passages like 1 Corinthians 15:33, right? Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. We know that verse. We've got it underlined, and we usually tell our kids all about that, right? And that's true. Just as someone can sharpen you or make you better, well, others can dull you and make you worse. And so we're warned about that kind of a friend, the one who corrupts good morals. There are some who lead you away, and they don't care about doing that because they don't follow the way themselves. But there are other friends, those true friends. Somebody whose commitment to you maybe is never spoken, but somebody who just helps you to be better. They're usually the first person you call when something goes wrong, and they're a source of encouragement. They comfort you, and they try to help steer you through those difficult times. And usually they're the first person you call when something goes right, right? They're really the ones who rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. They're a source of encouragement, support, comfort, whatever the situation calls for, they're there. Those kind of relationships are important. We need to cultivate those kinds of relationships. We just had our Moses Vacation Bible School. And the highlight for me, other than singing Booster, Booster, Be a Booster, was spending the time in the teen class with the kids and listening to them open up about the things that they have to deal with. We try to make some practical application from the things that Moses went through and the things that our young people go through. And one of the things I think that are most important to young people are their friends. I mean, usually they're at a stage in their life when a friend is usually closer than a parent. I don't know why it works that way, but a lot of times it just does. A friend is usually the one that they tell all the things that sometimes they don't even tell their own parents. The things that they fear. The things that they think about. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Our young people need friends. But they need certain kinds of friends. The Bible tells us about the friends that we ought to choose to be our friend, whether we're young or maybe not so young. For instance, we need a friend, someone who'll look out for you, like Jonathan. Go with me to 1 Samuel chapter 18. 1 Samuel chapter 18. Now, you know about David and Jonathan. In fact, they had a friendship that was really special. David had a friend like this, like we're talking about, somebody who'll look out for you. And right off the bat, they hit it off. In 1 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 1, it says, "It came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself." Now, they had a lot in common. They were both young, capable, and courageous. But they just had a great friendship right from the very beginning. Have you ever had a friend like that? Somebody that you meet from the first time, from the minute, it's like, wow, you too? We like the same things, and you just seem to, it's as if you've known each other forever from the first time you met. But more than just having something important in common together, their capability, their courage, their love for the Lord, they had a genuine affection for each other. And it tells us right here. Jonathan loved David as himself. And so that day, they made a covenant. They made a deal together. In verse 2, it says that Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Talking about David. Saul wanted David to serve him. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. So twice we're told that Jonathan loved David as himself. And they made the first of three covenants that they would make together. Actually, it's the same covenant. They just kept reaffirming it. They wanted to make sure that each other knew just how much they meant to each other. I remember when I was a kid. You ever have a blood brother or a blood sister? I don't know if women, if girls did it, but guys did it all the time. had a blood brother when I was a kid. We grew up together. We liked the same kind of things. And we were friends, but we wanted to be closer than friends. So one day we made a pact, a seal, a deal, and we sealed the deal with blood. We made little slits in our palms, and we clasped our hands together, and very solemnly we said to each other, "You are my blood brother." And that was it. From then on, we were very close, up until the day that he died. Jonathan and David had a special friendship, and it seemed to get deeper and sweeter the more time went on. And it was the kind of a friendship that was the basis for Jonathan to even stand up to his father, to be an encourager to David whenever his father, the king Saul, would start to get a little crazy from time to time. In 1 Samuel 19, there's an incident that happens here. Everybody's kind of together. Well, at least Jonathan and Saul are. And you already know about King Saul's sporadic incidents of, for lack of a better word, let's just call it nuttiness. Because from time to time, he seems to lose his mind. And this is one of those times. Verse 4 says that Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he's not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine," talking about Goliath. "And the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel, and you saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause?" Well, that seems like a reasonable statement to make to somebody of a sane mind, even to somebody who's not quite of a sane mind at that time. Why do you want to kill somebody? He's got nothing against you. Why would you want to do this to him? Now, keep in mind that this is a son talking to his father. And it's not just a son talking to his father. It's a son talking to his father, the king, who has the power to do whatever he wants. And that's the point. Jonathan would do whatever it took to defend David, even at personal risk. In chapter 20, look with me at chapter 20. In verse 30 of chapter 20, it says, "Saul's anger burned against Jonathan. He said to him, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you're choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore, now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die.' But Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said, 'Why should he be put to death? What's he done?' Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death." You think? I mean, your king, your father, the king, just hurled a spear at you to kill you simply because you defended your best friend. And that's the point. Jonathan did whatever he could even if David didn't always see those incidents, for David to know that he was always on his side. There was one conversation that they had where David and Jonathan are talking about the coming kingdom. And Jonathan tells him, "Look, I know that you're going to be king and I'm not." He says, "But when you are, I'm going to serve you. I'm going to be your right-hand man. I'm going to do everything it takes to support you as king." Now, Jonathan's father, Saul, wanted a dynasty. He wanted his son to be king. But Jonathan knew where the cards lay, and he knew that David had the rightful place to be king. Well, Jonathan never got to be David's right-hand man. He died before David became king. But David never forgot the kindness of Jonathan. He showed that kindness to Jonathan's own son, Mephibosheth, Jonathan's only remaining son. You see, for them, Proverbs 18:24 was true. Proverbs 18:24 says, "A man of too many friends comes to ruin. But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." And maybe one of the things that this proverb reminds us of is that it doesn't matter how many friends you have. What really matters is that you have at least one good friend. And for Jonathan and David, they were each other's one good friend. They knew the benefits of true friendship. They looked out for each other. So who's your Jonathan? Who is the one who'll look out for you? Who is the one who, even at personal risk, will stick by you, even when the cost is high? Who's your Jonathan? You need someone who'll not only stick by you, you also need somebody who's going to be a friend enough to tell it to you straight. Somebody like Nathan. In 2 Samuel, go there with me, 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11 tells us about David's great sin with Bathsheba. And I won't go into detail about it. You know it, but it was a sordid affair of immorality on several levels. Not just sexual immorality. There was also lying and covering up and finally murder. But David had an advisor, a fellow named Nathan. And Nathan was more than an advisor. He was a prophet. And he was even more than an advisor and a prophet. He was a friend to David at a time when David needed somebody really to tell it to him straight. In 2 Samuel 12, Nathan comes to David and knows that he's got to speak truth to power. He's got to tell David something that David, he doesn't know. He doesn't know whether how he's going to react to the news. But it's not good news. He's going to accuse him of guilt. In 2 Samuel chapter 12 and in verse 1, it says the Lord sent Nathan to David. And so he came to him and said, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he brought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie on his bosom. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herds to prepare for the wayfarer who would come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who would come to him. And then it says that David's anger burned greatly against the man. And he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. Now, Nathan comes to David with a parable, really, right? And he tells him this story, and David falls for it. He thinks it's true. And he says, whoever does this has taken something that doesn't belong to him. He deserves to die. Ooh, perfect opening, right? Nathan says in verse 7, you're the man. You're the one who took from someone who had far less than you, and you took it. Of course, David took more than a ewe lamb. He took another man's wife. But the point is, well taken. He had to tell him that God wasn't about to let him off the hook. He had sinned. Have you ever told someone who has more power than you do, maybe someone who has so much power over you that they hold your livelihood in their hands, and you tell them something that's unpleasant, but it's the truth, and they need to hear it? This is what's going on with David and Nathan. Nathan, I think, loved David enough to tell him what he wanted, what he needed to hear, not what he wanted to hear. And it takes. David is pierced to the heart, and he writes that beautiful Psalm of repentance, Psalm 51. I wish we had time to go there tonight, but we don't. But the realization of David's guilt, spoken from the lips of Nathan, hit him like a ton of bricks. Proverbs 27, verse 6 says, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. I know that there are some people who like to surround themselves with yes men. Somebody's going to pat them on the back all the time, tell them everything's fine. People who will fawn all over them, trip over themselves just to give them compliments. People who let you think you're okay when you're in deep trouble. People who do that aren't doing you any favors. When a friend who loves you confronts you, like Nathan did to David, when a friend loves you enough to tell you what may make you feel bad, but will really help you in the end, well, that's the kind of friend that you need. And instead of getting defensive, maybe what you need to do is just ask yourself a couple of simple questions. When someone confronts you with truth that's hard to hear, ask yourself, first of all, is this true? Be honest. Is it true? And then ask yourself, what should I do about this? If you're honest and if you're a person of integrity, you'll answer both of those questions sincerely and you'll know what the answers are. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Those wounds are faithful. They're true to what's best for you. And they come from a heart that really wants what's best for you, even if it hurts. Nathan was this kind of friend to David. He told it to him straight. So who's your Nathan? Who will speak to you truthfully, squarely, frankly, bluntly, hurtfully sometimes? Who will tell you what you need to hear? Not always what you want to hear. Who's your Nathan? Finally this evening, we need someone who'll not only stick to you, and someone who'll not only tell it to you straight, but when you're hurting, someone who'll pull you out of the pit like Ruth. Go with me to the little book of Ruth, right after the book of Judges. You'll find it nestled there between Ruth and 1 Samuel. I'm sorry, between Judges and 1 Samuel. What I mean by the pit is the pit of discouragement, the pit of despair, the pit of isolation, the pit of loneliness. You pick your pit. Sometimes we get into dark places like we talked about this morning. We get into the pit of despair, the pit of depression. And we need someone who will do their best to reach in and pull us out. Ruth did that for a woman that she really had absolutely no moral obligation to anymore. Her mother-in-law. We all know the beautiful story of Ruth. It's story of a woman who loses everything, Naomi. She had daughters-in-law who themselves lost their husbands. And so deep was Naomi's despair that she wanted her name to reflect it. She changed her name to Mara, which means bitter, because that's exactly how she felt. She felt bitter against the Lord. She was angry with God. But what she didn't realize was that she had a godsend in her daughter-in-law, Ruth. Naomi carried this heavy load of frustration, resentment, sorrow, and bitterness. But Ruth wanted to help ease that load. And Ruth wasn't about to let Naomi go through this difficulty alone. Naomi's other daughter-in-law, Orpah, she got the opportunity to go back home to her family. And probably a little apprehensive about not being able to care for herself. That's what she does. That's what she did. She went back home to her family. But Ruth would not leave Naomi's side. You know the beautiful words that she spoke to Ruth, to Naomi. Look at me in Ruth chapter 1. Begin with me in verse 16. Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. Now, we're used to hearing this passage quoted sometimes at weddings, and I guess it's appropriate there, but this is not a wedding. This is a solemn meeting between two women who have lost everything. And one of them is telling her mother-in-law, "I won't let you go through this alone." They're sealing a relationship together. And it takes the younger one to reinforce it to the older one. Ruth says, "I know what you've lost, but I'm not going to let you go through it alone. I'm going to go with you. I'll accept your God. I'll live with you. I'll bear whatever burden or loss that you have to bear." And make no mistake, it wasn't going to be easy for either one of them. These are two women who lived in a very patriarchal society. They needed some help, but they needed each other more. And Ruth was determined to tough it out, no matter how difficult it was going to be. She was determined to help Naomi survive. And Ruth trusted in Naomi's God to help do this. And of course, the rest of the story, you know that story. We looked at it not very long ago, about a year and a half ago, but you know the rest of that story. It's a beautiful drama that unfolds and opens the way for David to come and be king. And later on, the King of Kings to descend from that lineage. Sometimes there is absolutely no friend like someone who'll just be there with you. Look with me in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. In Ecclesiastes 4, the wise man tells us about the benefit of strength in numbers. Not very many numbers, but enough to matter. In Ecclesiastes 4, in verse 9, he says, two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. There is somebody who will stick with you through thick and thin. And it's easy to stick with someone when times are sunshiny and happy. It's much more difficult to let someone know they can lean on you when times are dark and difficult. But I think that's part of what Ecclesiastes 4 is telling us, that we need somebody who can help us stand against those difficult times. Now, he talks about labor, and it's true that when two people put their hand to the plow, as it were, that it makes the workload easier. But there's another kind of burden that we sometimes bear. The burden of difficulty when we feel isolated and alone. The burden that we bear when we feel that no one understands what we're going through. The burden that we bear when we feel like we just can't depend on anybody. And then there's that special person, that one, maybe the one out of all the dozens of friends that you might have, that's there always, and especially when times are tough, through thick and thin, through joy or pain, through good or bad. They're your Ruth. They reach down, they pull you up, and they help set you on level ground again. So who's your Ruth? Who's your Jonathan? Who's your Nathan? For our young people, a new summer has started, right? And there's all kinds of stuff that awaits. There's adventure, there's fun times, but there's also trouble, temptation, enticement, to do the wrong thing. And you're going to be faced with all kinds of situations this summer. And even though you've been strong against those things in the past, you're going to need a friend who's going to be able to tell you exactly what it is you need to know and what you need to do. So, who will look out for you? Who will tell it to you straight? Who will help you out of the pit? Jesus. Jesus. He's the one you can count on. I want our young people to know that it's so good to have friends. And I know at this stage in your life, you probably are closer to your friends than your parents. That's just the way things go. And I get that. But realize that there is a friend who's even got a closer knit bond with you than your best bud. That friend is Jesus. And that's a friend who will never let you down. Because even your best friend may do that at some point. But Jesus never, never, never will. I want our young people to know how important it is that you start considering Jesus now. These carefree days of summer are going to come and they're going to go. And we've got at least one grad, we've got two grads that we know. We've got Christy and Christian, who have graduated, and they're going to be setting their sights on bigger and higher things and things that are more adult. And I certainly want them to know, as I want our younger people to know as well, that whatever you go through, no matter what you go through in life, there's always one that you can count on. I want you to know that you can count on your brethren here in the church. I stress to our young people all the time to be friendly with those who were older than them. I know usually we stick to our own age groups, but I want our young people to know that if you make friends with a gray-haired person, it's not the worst thing in the world. They've got lots of wisdom. They've got lots of practical help. They've got lots of good that they can help you with. But there is no friend like Jesus. Choose him, and choose him first. You're going to have an opportunity now. In a moment, we're going to stand and sing the song. The song is intended to get you to realize just how important it is that you make that decision, and you make that decision now. If you're not a Christian, you can be. This evening, before we leave this place, you can make that great confession. I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, making your decision to turn from sin, believing that Jesus died for you. And before we leave this place, you will be wet from the waters of baptism that have washed your sins away. And if you've already done that, and you realize that sometimes you dance a little too close to the fire, listen to your friend Jesus and what he wants for you. If we can help you, we want to. Will you come while we stand and sing?